WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 25% of our prescription drugs contain an active ingredient derived from a plant. Many of those plants come from the rainforest, and you know what's happening to the rainforests. My guest, Christopher Joyce, is the author of the new book, Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. He says ethnobotanists, cancer researchers, and pharmaceutical companies are part of a new radical experiment. Its goal is to change the way people search for and test potential new medicines, and to preserve the world's great forests by showing how valuable its plants are, both medically and financially. Joyce is an editor and reporter at NPR. As part of his research, he traveled through South American rainforests with ethnobotanists and representatives of pharmaceutical companies. He told me it's a long, involved process, transforming a rainforest plant into a prescription drug.
The process probably takes 10, 15 years from start to finish, at least.
Why does it take so long? You know, if you bring back a plant, you know it has a certain healing effect. Why should it take 15 years?
Well, often you don't know it has a healing effect. You're merely bringing back lots and lots of plants. The National Cancer Institute is an example. They're right now embarked on a huge program of vacuuming the rainforest as well as tropical oceans for interesting organisms with interesting compounds. But then you have to, in the past, you take it and you give it to a rat, and if it has an effect on the rat, you then take it from there. Nowadays, we're able to be more specific. We can use the test tube and use that to find out whether, for example, an extract from a plant or an insect does something in the test tube to, say, the AIDS virus. Let's say it does. Well, you've got 50 compounds in there. Which one is the one? It's a very lengthy process to sort of winnow out the other 49 compounds till you find the one that's actually doing the work. After that, you have to test it on various types of AIDS viruses. You also have to then test it for toxicity. That is, well, maybe it'll kill the AIDS virus, but it might also kill the patient. And that takes a long time. And then, of course, it has to go through the government review. And you know, drugs take a long time, and this is one of the reasons why.
There's a new framework for relationships between the pharmaceutical companies and the indigenous people who live in the rainforest. You say the most contentious issue now is about intellectual property rights. How do intellectual property rights apply to plants in the rainforest?
That's a difficult problem, and I don't think anybody has solved it. The political climate nowadays is quite different from when people would go off to the rainforest, botanists for pharmaceutical companies or governments, and simply take what they wanted in exchange for boat motors or machetes or a few shotguns. Nowadays, tropical countries are very wary of the intrusion of northern scientists, and yet there's really no legal framework, certainly not an international legal framework, that will protect third world countries and protect their, their flora and fauna, their genetic resources. There have been some attempts in the Rio Treaty that was just signed by President Clinton after the Rio Summit on the Environment, which has made an attempt to, at least in principle, set down the idea that these resources do belong to the people in the countries where they're found. And yet, really, it's sort of a case-by-case situation. When a drug company or a government decides to go to, say, a country like Panama or Ecuador, it's really up to the local people to be able to demand the kind of exchange of money or technological transfer in exchange for the biological wealth that they still own.
So what's at issue is whether countries have rights to indigenous plants in the way they, say, have rights to their own natural resources and minerals if an outsider came in and mined them.
That's a good way of looking at it, and a good analogy, I think, is a term that's commonly being used now is chemical prospecting. Chemical prospecting being the idea that you go into a rainforest which is chemically rich, and you mine it. You prospect first, and you find what's valuable, and the beauty in it is that you can do it renewably. You don't have to yank out all the plants. You can find a few of them and try to bring them back and propagate them at home. If you can't do that, you propagate them there. Again, the intellectual property rights question and the political question here is, what do you give or guarantee to the people in that community, the people in that state, the people in that country, especially if that plant also happens to be found, for example, in a country in Asia as well as South America? Who has the right to it? Who owns a work of nature? And it's a very difficult concept that nobody in any country really has pinned down.
There's even the question of royalties now.
Well, royalties is a good way to approach it, and there is a model. There has been a real groundbreaking experiment and agreement between Merck, which is the world's largest pharmaceutical company, and an organization in Costa Rica called INBIO, Instituto Nacional de Biodiversidad, which basically means the National Biodiversity Institute. And what the Costa Ricans have done basically is say to Merck and Company and others who might be interested that, look, we're turning our country, it has tens and tens of thousands of unique plants and unique insects. We're turning it into a nursery. And if you want to get in, you have to pay at the door. And if you find anything, then we'll do some of the upfront work. We'll do some of the extraction. We'll do some of the chemical analysis. You do the medical testing. And if you find something that turns it into a drug, you owe us a royalty. This was agreed to in 1992. I believe they signed the agreement. And it's really the first in the world where such an agreement's been signed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Joyce. His new book is called Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. There's another group of people that call themselves eco-rationalists that are also looking for plant substances with healing effects in the rainforest. How does their approach differ with the ethnobotanists?
Well, the eco-rationalists, they're self-named, I think. I don't know that the ethnobotanists would agree with this term rationalist. They all work rationally. But for lack of a better term, these are people who dismiss the shamanistic approach. They say, look, we really don't need to spend our time talking with shamans in villages who are the last of actually a dying breed of indigenous people who understand the curing plants of their cultures. Given the fact that we have such powerful technology at home, what we really need to do is just simply look, based on our own botanical knowledge, we know that certain families of plants, let's say Myristicaceae, that's a tropical family of plants, or some other family that in the past has given us a lot of very powerful bioactive compounds. We know that's been good in the past. Let's go collect unusual Myristicaceae. Let's go collect unusual Melastomataceae and bring it back and just put it into the maw of these huge testing operations that now companies have set up. And we can run them through hundreds, if not thousands, of different plants per day. And just look for hits. We don't need to mess around with the kinds of compounds that shamans use, many of which simply have some sort of active effect, but we really don't know what it is, and we're much more interested in specialized single compounds, not a mass of chemicals that comes out of a plant.
Yeah, and these eco-rationalists have criticized the shaman approach to finding plants as being too broad spectrum, you know, that you don't know specifically what the substance on the plant does and what it affects because the plants are used more as a cure-all.
Yes, they're looking, most pharmaceutical companies and medicinal botanists are looking for something very specific. For example, something that cuts down on the buildup of cholesterol or something.
A concept that people in the rainforest wouldn't even know.
Certainly not. They know that a certain plant, like a varola was one that I came across in Ecuador. It happens to be a tree whose bark has been used for centuries as a hallucinogen. It was used in ceremonial practices, and shamans use it to be able to see visions to know how to cure their patients. But the bark is also, as we've found out recently, quite useful at working on fungal infections. And the native peoples there rub it on fungal infections on their arms and legs, and it seems to work quite well. But nobody knows. There's probably 50 or 60 or 70 different phytochemicals, as we call them, plant chemicals, in that bark. Who knows which one actually works and who knows what doesn't? Furthermore, many of the concoctions that shamans put together contain 8 or 9 or 10 different kinds of plants. And even if it works, nobody really knows which part of it works. And you can't give people here in the United States a concoction like that and say, well, cross your fingers and hope it works.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Joyce, and we're talking about his new book, Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Joyce. We're talking about his new book, Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. You traveled with ethnobotanists through the rainforest in Costa Rica and Ecuador. Did you actually travel with people who were working with shamans in trying out plant substances?
Yes, I did. I traveled in Ecuador with Brad Bennett, who's an ethnobotanist now at Florida International University and also associated with the New York Botanical Garden, which is probably the center for ethnobotany in North America or United States, certainly. Brad was familiar with several indigenous groups in Ecuador, the Shuar Indians, for example, and the Shuar people, now numbering perhaps 20,000 left in existence, living in the western Amazon. He lived with them for many months over a two-year period, studying their indigenous, their useful plants, and covering everything from medicines to food to baskets to housing. And I traveled with him to a couple of places. We went to a place called Hatun Sacha, which is a biological research station in the Amazon, and lived with the Quechua people who lived nearby the biological station and studied their useful plants. They took us through the forest. The way this usually works is you just simply go for a long walk through the forest with a couple of shamans or people who know the healing plants of their culture. And you probably pay them by the day, and they tell you, basically pointing from plant to plant, what they're used for, if they're used for anything at all. Brad would swap information. He might well recognize the family of the plant, give them the Latin name. So there's an exchange of information. Brad Bennett would also always publish his findings in the local language, Spanish there or the Quechua language, and return that information to them. He himself was not working for a drug company. He's simply an academic. But, of course, what he was able to find out may be used someday by people interested in pharmaceuticals, because he did take chemical samples from trees. You also take physical samples, leaves, flowers, bark, and you also take chemical samples, say, from the sap. We also traveled to northwest Ecuador to visit the Chachi people, who number even fewer, very few left of the Chachi, and in a very remote area of Ecuador, and studied their healing plants from their shamans.
So when Bennett would give a shaman the Latin name for a plant, would that be of any value at all to the shaman?
Well, they found it to be interesting. Brad Bennett, as many ethnobotanists do, don't just come down for a week or so. He would go back and forth and sometimes spend months and months with these cultures and would exchange information about what he knew about, say, the indigenous plants of other peoples living in various parts of the Amazon. He would bring them documents about tropical botany. He would help them economically wherever he could. He doesn't have a lot of money himself. And because he's a practicing ethnobotanist, he does subscribe to the idea that you try as much as you can to return value. He's, again, not working for a drug company, but, for example, he's with the Chachi Indians, he set up a system for them to be able to sell some of their indigenous art products, baskets and weavings and that sort of thing, in North America to help their local economy in the village where he worked.
Did you participate in any rituals or ceremonies while you were in the rainforest?
I didn't myself. Brad Bennett did quite often, and some of the other people I traveled with when we were visiting the Chachi Indians in northwestern Ecuador did participate. It's not a terribly edifying or enjoyable experience. Sometimes it goes on all night. Many of the shamans drink a lot of rum, and some of the ceremonies include smoking a lot of cigarettes and spitting rum on the affected part of the body. Ritual acts like sucking stones or sucking demons out of the body. Often the shamans will take hallucinogenic drugs from plants, of course. Ayahuasca is one of them. It comes from a vine that's common in the Western, well, all over the Amazon. It can go on all night and be rather an exhausting affair. What some people misunderstand, though, is that it's not all hocus-pocus, because they also use, in these ceremonies, herbal remedies. And some of these herbal remedies actually do work. Again, they're broad spectrum. They may not be very specific, but it's those herbal remedies, not the ceremonial sort of demonstrations that go on around it, that ethnobotanists are particularly interested in.
Were you curious to try any of the hallucinogenics?
I was curious about it. At the time, it really wasn't a good thing to do. It's not as if the indigenous peoples that we visited haven't seen Westerners before, and unfortunately they have seen people who come down looking for a sort of a fun trip.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, ethnobotanists really frown on this, because it gives them and the people who come with them a bad reputation. These hallucinogenic plants are very, very important, in fact, holy plants for the indigenous people. And most of the time, they don't take them for a lark. They take them during ceremonies at which they communicate with spirits. Their shamans take them because they're privileged members of their society. And for a Westerner to come down and, stick a snuff tube up his nose and snort a bunch of powder, may make good publicity, but I think you'll find a lot of ethnobotanists frown on the practice.
You know what I found interesting? That ethnobotanists now are not only looking for plants, but they're looking for insects, too. What do they hope to find in insects? And I'm wondering, too, if you participated in any insect tracking.
Actually, when I was in, for example, in Costa Rica, we were looking for plants and microorganisms. We would take samples of roots and samples of earth around roots.
Looking what for tend, funguses and
right, funguses and microorganisms that that might be useful as well.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't look for insects, although it's quite popular in Costa Rica, and it's part of the arrangement that Merck and Company has with the Costa Ricans. Insects certainly have a fantastic armamentarium of chemicals, toxic chemicals that they use to fight off predators, for example, or pheromones that they use. These are hormones or compounds that they use to communicate, basically, or to attract other insects when they're mating. It's a huge panoply of compounds in insects that people really have barely begun to scratch the surface.
So what do the experts in the field think the odds are that there are great drugs that have not been discovered yet within the plants of the rainforest?
If you count all the flowering plants of the world, you come up with about 250,000. And according to some of the botanists, or many of the botanists that I've talked to, probably only 1, 2, 3, maybe even 5% tops have been looked at in a methodical chemical way. So it's fair to say that there's a vast number out there, over 200,000 different species of plants, that we have no idea what's inside them.
What gives you the most hope that pharmaceutical companies realize the potential for medicinal plants in the rainforest?
One, the fact that several of them, and also the U.S. government, are spending a few million dollars, not a lot, but a few million, to go back to the rainforest, to hire botanists who otherwise might not have the money to do this, to go back and do inventories and to collect plants. It's begun. That's hopeful. Secondly, already within the past 4 or 5 years since this has been going on, we have now about 4 or 5 or 6 new compounds, I think 3 or 4 of them apparently effective against AIDS in the test tube only, I must emphasize. They're very interesting. One's a vine from Cameroon. Another is a tree from Sarawak in Malaysia. We also have a compound from a seaweed that was found in the Philippines. And, of course, there's this herpes, potential herpes drug from the wound healing agent that was found in Ecuador. So there's several possibilities that could produce drugs over the next few years. And I think even the fact that they're interesting chemically and are in clinical trials and with humans, or on the verge of clinical trials, that in itself is promising. And of course, if one of them breaks through and actually becomes a money-making drug, I think we're on the road to possibly a different way of looking at the rainforest.
The ingredient that you mentioned can work against AIDS. Is it against HIV itself or against opportunistic infections that come with AIDS?
There are a couple of compounds that seem to work against HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Again, it's only in the test tube, but the National Cancer Institute discovered a plant called Ancistrocladus. It's a vine that grows in the rainforest in Cameroon. From that, they have now isolated a single compound. They call it michelamine, which is named after the wife of the researcher who found it. And it is promising. It has some problem. It's quite toxic. But if they can get the toxicity down so that you don't kill the patient, they are rather enthusiastic about it. And they've got a couple others like that. One of the unfortunate problems, and it reinforces the argument here, is that... For example, the West African plant is very hard to propagate in a nursery. It's taken wild at the moment. They have a nursery growing in Cameroon at a secret location. They're rather worried about a run on this plant. But it's very hard to grow it. So the tree that was found in Malaysia, in Sarawak, they took a random sample of a whole bunch of plants from the area. This one was a hit, seemed to work in the test tube. Went back to collect more of it, and the tree was gone. It had been cut down, and it turned out to be the only individual tree of that species they could find. Now, luckily, they've been able to go back and find related species that seem to have the same chemical compound or a close analog of that compound, not quite as effective, and they're working with that, hoping that they can synthesize this compound eventually based on what they know. But it only... served to point out that here today and gone tomorrow is a sad fact of chemical prospecting in the rainforest.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Christopher Joyce is the author of Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.